welcome to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today we are delighted to welcome back to the studio two award-winning political cartoonists who have been much in the news lately, Matt Boers and Ted Rall. Great to see you again.
Hey, always a pleasure.
Yeah, so the last time we talked on KBOO, the two of you had just returned from an unembedded tour through Afghanistan, and that was not even 2 years ago, but there's been a lot going on since then. Ted, you have a new book coming out, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. It's being published by Seven Stories Press.
It's just out this week, actually, and I'm starting a tour here in Portland and going up to Seattle, Olympia, Tacoma, Bellingham, and then down to San Francisco, and I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, I was interested in the tone of the book because not too long ago you were calling for President Obama to resign for, in your words, completely abandoning all the principles that he had put forward in his campaign. And now in the book, you're kind of going easy on him. You're saying, you know, he was the best we could have gotten, but just nobody can change the system.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to probably hone this talking point a little more because people are not getting it. You know, I mean, yes, he's the best that this system is capable of producing. And I'm saying that, you know, he exposes the fact that the system rather than the personality is the problem. And, you know, under Bush, we could say, well, if we had a better president, if we had a president who could speak English, we'd be in business. And then, you know, now we have a president who can speak English and clearly we're not in business. Nothing's being done about unemployment. You know, the economy is a disaster and it's not even really being talked about in a serious way by the leadership class. And so when I say that he's the best that the system is capable of providing, that's not to say that he's any good at all. He's actually completely useless.
Not to say we shouldn't have a revolution.
Should have a revolution. And in fact, people are confused by the idea that, things can get better and still get worse at the same time. You can have a better personality in charge of a system that is decaying all the same. And that's exactly what's happening. I mean, it is confusing, for sure.
Yeah, one of my biggest problems with him is just that he's kind of ensconced a lot of these things that Bush did into and normalized them, like drone attacks, and expanded on them in some ways.
Now, spying on our phone calls, reading our emails.
One thing that you can say Bush actually didn't do was assert the right to assassinate U.S. citizens abroad with drones.
He did not. Or actually, I think he asserts the right to assassinate U.S. citizens domestically with drones as well.
I'm sure.
There's no exception.
We're probably going to see that happen in our lifetime, I think.
Oh, I don't think you're going to have to wait very long.
Domestic terrorist attack. Turn it up again. Bust out the next Patriot Act.
Yeah, I mean, and let's not forget other stuff that, people on the left have already forgotten about the Bush tax cuts for the rich that Obama kept.
The thing I find frustrating as a political cartoonist is my sense that there are things that people should be outraged about that I want to treat with the same irreverence or whatever, or critique it just as harder, that liberals just aren't as upset about. I mean, if John McCain had not closed Gitmo, had been killing people with drones, expanded drone attacks, killed a U.S. citizen, people would be flipping.
For sure. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, in that way, I think it's always worse for the left when Democrats are in charge because there's a reflexive desire on the part of Democrats, of liberals to defend Democrats. But you mentioned like the difficulty of being a cartoonist and trying to draw attention to an issue that you think ought to be really important, but it's not. And it's so interesting. I mean, you just sort of never know, in a sense, what people will react to. But like you had a cartoon a week or two ago,
yeah,
that was just astonishing about two Native Americans, right? Like it's maybe you want to describe the cartoon. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was real simple. One panel. It was about the census numbers that came out that said that non-white baby births had surpassed white births for the first time in America. And so I had two Native Americans sitting there, and the first one said, or the radio actually said, non-white babies have surpassed white babies in America for the first time. And then one of the guy goes, second.
It's been the second time. It's the second time.
Yeah,
this has happened
and
before.
That was definitely like far and away one of the most popular cartoons I've ever done.
I knew it would be.
It was flying.
Remember I called you? I was like, yeah. This thing's a monster. I wish I'd thought of it.
So the title of your book is The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Are we now fully in the age of revolt, or is it a hopeful thing, or do you think it's just starting to steamroll here?
Well, we're clearly in the, well, we're not steamrolling. We're clearly at the beginning of the age of revolt, but we are at the beginning. You know, in 2009, the Tea Party came out. Last fall, we had Occupy Wall Street. Occupy or something else is going to be busy this summer.
And then there was the Arab Spring last year.
Right. And but, you know, yeah, my focus is more domestic. But yeah, I think that there's, you know, no doubt that a sizable minority of Americans who used to be part of the Democratic and Republican duopoly are now looking outside it.
Right. And speaking of domestic front, well, your Afghanistan trip, Ted, it was funded in part by a successful Kickstarter campaign.
And keyword being successful.
Yeah, and not so successful was the domestic Kickstarter project, a self-help book for the leaders of the next U.S. revolution. And right on the page there, it would say, congratulations, you have overthrown the government of the United States. And that's part comics journalism, part graphic novel, and a serious effort to imagine the nuts and bolts of how revolution will go down here in America. And you included in there how to take over the Oval Office on the first day of the revolution. That sort of thing.
I think you might have found the only self-help book topic that has not been touched upon yet.
You know, I mean, it didn't make the $40,000 that I thought I needed to do the project. But, you know, in fairness, I got over 100 backers, almost $10,000. I didn't get it, unless you get it all. But, I mean, people promised up to $10,000. That's pretty impressive. There's definitely an interest, but I think the economy's real tough. It's, I think it's also hard to ask fans to donate multiple times if they gave for the Afghanistan thing. Maybe they're thinking, you know, it's kind of like when you get married your second time, you know, you don't get as many gifts. people might not come to the wedding. I think it's kind of like that. So, it's one of those projects that it really was the perfect Kickstarter project in that, you know, either people had to get behind it and support it because like mainstream publishers would not, or it just couldn't be done. So it's kind of like letting the people vote. And they voted. And I, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, I accept the will of the people.
And, well, it's a high dollar amount, $40,000. So what was that $40,000 going to go to
as part of the project? Mostly drugs and prostitutes. Travel. I was going to go to places where there are revolutionary zones that are currently occupied by insurgent groups, places like the Naxalite Rebellion in Nepal, the Niger River Delta rebels in Africa, and Venezuela, to talk to people who are living in areas where they had to assume revolutionary control over, you know, an area they had to administer. You know, it's one thing to take over, but then you have to run a state. You have to sometimes make new, you have to mint money. You have to guard borders. You have to have a justice system, even if it's primitive. That's what I'm really interested in looking at because, I think a lot of when Americans think like, well, we can't have a revolution, they can't imagine a system that doesn't look like 50 states, a constitution, a capital named Washington, D.C., you know, a 1040 form filled out every year. They just can't imagine it. And so the idea is like, well, obviously, there's lots of ways you could do this.
So what's your rough vision? I mean, without doing the research that you wanted to do, I mean, what was your rough vision for how the citizen takeover of the U.S. would go down?
Well, how the, you know, I mean, the book doesn't, would not have addressed that. The book would have completely just addressed like, it has happened. We don't know how it has happened. It just has
wink,
happened.
Wink, wink.
Right. And wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But in terms of, I mean, look, nobody knows what will happen. I mean, you can't, I mean, you know, the French Revolution was triggered by the drunken ravings of the Marquis de Sade. You know, nobody really knows how revolution will start. All you know is that you have a lot of dry tinder, a lot of sparks flying around. Eventually, something happens, and then how it unfolds, you don't know if it's in stages, like in Egypt, they're kind of like in between stages, or if it's going to be more like France, where it's a series of convulsions, or the Soviet Union, where things have unfolded rather dramatically and more quickly in general. So, you know, I mean, who knows? It could be a regional revolution. It could be a secession. In the United States, there's just no way to tell. I mean, it's no two revolutions are the same.
So let's take the page one of the book that you had, and you may still want to get out somewhere down the line.
If someone sends me a check for $40,000.
Or 30, you're at
Yeah, I'm a whore. I would do totally take 25.
So day one, liberation, and it's the Oval Office. And Ted Rall is leading this revolution, or the revolution
has
happened.
He's just the self-hope guru.
Okay, but,
yeah,
but
well, a true revolution
is the first through the door.
Okay. A good revolution is democratic.
Okay, so what's your strategy here?
Well, I have to admit that personally, I think that the first order of business is to close borders and prevent capital flight. And I would go on television and announce that the death penalty has been abolished for all except for one crime, capital flight, because it's what capital flight is what kills revolutions. You know, if you look at one country after another, whenever there's been like in Russia, in France, when money leaves it, and when it does, the economy collapses. And then the revolutionary government, which has its hands full as it is unable to pay for goods and services, to pay salaries, to keep law and order going. So you just can't have that.
Stay in the country, a revolutionary will be by.
Oh, you
soon
can leave the
Caesar.
Country, yeah. But your money stays here. Yeah. It's like if you try to flee across the border, if we find a dime in your pocket, we're going to shoot you on sight. Don't leave with the money. Like, don't wire it. Don't try. Just, you know, and like, you know, in 6 to 12 months, we'll revisit this and we'll. But right now, it's like that's the first order of business. And I think then after that, you know, I think we would have to do a radical foreign policy revamp where we would apologize to the world for the and promise to make amends and bring our troops home, close our foreign bases, except where countries ask us to maintain them. But there we really
without some sort of. Undue pressure.
Without pressure. Because we don't want to maintain them. But, I mean, I can imagine there might be instances where a few countries would want us to remain. But we need to transition these people back. And we need to make amends for all the crimes that the former regime is guilty of. I mean, there's a lot of other, like, you know, kind of trash pickup kind of things you have to take care of. I mean, you know, you have to round up all your possible counter-revolutionaries and intern them, you know, right away. I mean, there's you have to make a list and check it twice and make and then like form re-education.
Shave the heads of the former regime and parade them on television.
There's going to have to be trials. I mean, there have to be people's trials. I mean, can you really allow like corporate executives who laid off thousands of people to like live another day? I don't think so.
Are you getting fitted for epaulettes right now?
I mean, you know, really, it's like how can you have a revolution without justice? You can't. You know, you have to make a clean break.
Well, speaking of justice, investigative reporter Greg Pallast, good friend of KABU, has been working on a book with you, and the title is Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. And this sounds like a timely book for an election year.
A very Palestinian title.
Oh.
Yes, he's you know, I was giving him shit for taking so much all of his titles out of like Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, well, anyway, he has a knack for a good turn of phrase.
So what's
billionaire
your
bankster bastards and their something
bilking
butts.
So what's your involvement in the Greg Pallast book?
I am doing the cover and I'm doing a comic book insert. So there's kind of like a 48 page full color little mini comic in the middle in the form of a horror comic, like an EC Comics.
Oh,
kind
nice.
Of,
yeah.
You
cool.
know, well, he had Greg Iceman featuring.
Greg Pallast had Lucas Kettner, one of our fantastic Portland cartoonists who does horror comics, illustrate a Steal Back Your Vote pamphlet a few years ago.
I remember that.
So he likes the cartoonists.
Yeah, no, Greg's good that way. I mean, he really, you know, he's one of those people, one of those journalists who understands what we do and understands what makes good comics. I mean, it's amazing to work with him. I mean, he's
collaborated with a few cartoonists.
Yeah.
I think he did stuff with Lloyd Dangle.
He just lets you do whatever.
That's cool.
He's like, yeah, just do it. Like, and what's really cool is he wants it to be really comic-y. Like on the cover, I was like, oh, I want to typeset the title. And he's like, no, I want it to look really comic-y. And like, I want you to like hand-letter the...
That's pretty much the only time you'll ever hear that about a book cover design.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's crazy. I was like, okay, fine, you know? Yeah, it's like, usually cartoonists, it's kind of like people... It's not even that we're disrespected. It's that we're like distrusted and feared.
Yeah.
I don't know why. We're harmless.
Well, for one thing, you've been on Al Jazeera, which is actually, this was a very cool interview. You were on the Riz Khan show with a strangely muted PJ O'Rourke as your foil.
I'd always wanted to go head to head with PJ.
And this you can find on the Seven Stories Press website. That must have been fun for you.
Yeah, just because, I mean, honestly, I always admired P.J. O'Rourke. I mean, there aren't many funny conservatives. And, you know, he's not consistently funny, but he's funny a lot, mm-hmm. which is surprising for a right-winger.
Oh, Holidays in Hell is
But he's not that right-wing yeah. either. I mean, he's like libertarian, old school kind of. I mean, you know, he's like wry and snotty. And so, yeah, it was exciting for that reason. I mean, you know, it's not fun to go up against like an idiot like Sean Hannity. You know,
because yeah, you were on Hannity and Combs a number of times, a frequent guest, also Bill Maher's Real Time. But yeah, Hannity and Combs, I mean, these guys really do play it like it's entertainment, though, don't they? Or do they play it straight?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I think that Hannity really takes it seriously. I mean, because he's like that off the air. Like Bill O'Reilly's not like that at all. Off the air, he's a gentleman. He is very professional. He, you know, he shoots the breeze with you, you know, exchanges vacation info with you. But I think he's bipolar, to be honest, really, truly. I mean, he's got that, like, that look in his eye. Suddenly he changes. You know, it's kind of like suddenly the eyes snap.
Well, I think both, a lot of those guys have some serious, like, anger issues or...
For sure. Yeah, and Hannity is the absolute worst. I mean, Hannity may kill someone.
They're basically
someday.
Bullies. I mean, like, Hannity's and O'Reilly's whole thing is to have people on, and the people who aren't on there to reinforce and agree with them, they have on to, like, completely berate and bully.
Right. And they cheat, you know? I mean, like, they have all the tech advantages, right? So they tamp you down while you're, even if you have some nads and you're yelling back at them, it doesn't help because yours is yelling, but no one can hear you. They just see your mouth moving. And then Sean's there is just like going on and on as if you weren't even there.
They can just, if you
want to. Sean's live.
Oh, okay. I know O'Reilly's taped earlier in the day.
It's kind of like where Krusty the Clown on the Simpsons episode is running for Congress and he's on Fox News with the Democrat that they're drawing devil horns on. And
yeah, it's totally what it's like. And they even commit ergonomic warfare. Like they have like the host is like in a wonderful Aeron chair, which probably has magic fingers
like
scratching
you.
Their butts. Yeah, he's above you and like you're down about 6 to 12 inches and you're in a little secretary's chair with a broken like, you know, I don't know what you call it, the thing that holds the seat up. It kind of like tilts. So, like, if you lean to one side, it's like thunk. And you're like, I mean, I swear, and others have written about this. It's like, it's intentional. You know, it's all part of like Roger Ailes' insanity.
Psychological warfare.
Fortunately, I fare okay because, you know, I was bullied as a kid and abused as a child by my parents. So, I'm trained for this.
Yeah, I mean, no, you love to.
If you're a well rounded human being, you shouldn't go on these shows.
Well, you love to give as good as you get, which is one reason why you're popular on, say, Real Time with Bill Maher. You're a quick talker, which helps certainly.
You have to be.
And yeah, I mean, you're a celebrity.
You see people who are just normal and smart, you know, on those shows, professors and people like that, and they like sort of take a beat to think about something. It's like television death.
Yeah, you notice they never have cartoonists on in any of these shows. I mean, you're really one of the only people that's ever been on in any capacity on any of these shows. I don't know why they never have any political cartoonists.
Very different.
I mean, they would really liven up some of these horrible Sunday
shows.
In the
70s, man, I used to see like Mike Peters and Jeff McNally and a whole host of like minor league editorial cartoonists like Robert Ariel and people like that. And they would be on like, you know, the evening news doing analysis. They were on like NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and Robert McNally.
How far we've fallen.
We have.
Well, speaking of which, one of the great legendary editorial cartoonists, Herbert Block, who was the bane of Richard Nixon and Joe McCarthy back in the day, and he kept on drawing until 2000, 2001. I remember reading his cartoons as a kid in the paper. Yeah, Herb Block, he did that scratchy pencil shading nobody does anymore, and now he has an award named after him. And this year's Herb Block Prize winner is Matt Bors. And I know, Matt, you were in Washington, D.C. My understanding is Doonesbury creator Gary Trudeau was the guy who actually handed the award to you?
He didn't physically hand it to me, but he gave like the address, the keynote, the lecture that night. And so I got to meet him for the first time, which was cool. We chatted in the green room and just kind of exchanged pleasantries. And you know, I wasn't sure whether or not he knew of my work before he was given the assignment to give the lecture or not. Probably not. And, you know, they probably said, here's Herb Block a winner, check out his work a little bit. And that was probably the first time he ever heard of me. But he was nice and he gave a good speech.
And you have an acceptance speech that's out there, I believe, on your website.
I posted it on my blog somewhere. I mean, okay. It's just like Matt Bors, Herb Block on YouTube, and you can find it. But I don't know that it's
No, you're too modest. It's a really good speech. I mean, I was jealous. I was like, I can't believe what a good speaker he is.
Oh, right. So well, good. Ted, you are a multi-award winner. You're the two-time recipient of the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. And during our last visit, you were bemoaning the fact that Matt wasn't getting the recognition he deserved. And since then, Matt's been on a roll. You may be in his shadow pretty soon.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, I think it's important for like the, you know, for seriously, at this point, I'm 48 years old. I'll be 49 this summer. I'm not ready to retire yet, but I think it's really important to respect the younger up and coming artists and creators, and to be graceful and to support them and to be willing in some ways to step aside. Yeah. And I didn't feel like that happens enough in our profession.
Yeah, it's been cool. I said in the speech, the Herblock Award was the first award that I've ever won, and then I also got an SPJ and was a Pulitzer finalist this year. So that's I'm just kind of soaking it up because I'm not going to be a Herblock winner and Pulitzer finalist every year.
Well, right, you were both Ted and Matt. You were both Pulitzer finalists.
It's us and
Jules Pfeiffer.
And Jules Pfeiffer won. Are the only three alties who've ever been Pulitzer finalists.
Which is
Pfeiffer won.
Yeah, which is like a crime against all of the great cartoonists who
think about Tom Tomorrow doesn't deserve to be a Pulitzer finalist. He deserves to win.
Yeah, there are people with staff jobs, kind of mainstream cartoonists who have had been like three, four-time finalists and two-time winners. It's kind of
Jack Oman was a finalist for the first time, even though he's been like a brilliant, you know, and top, you know, everyone respects him in the field since he was really young, since he was like 20.
Yeah, I mean, the Pulitzer is something that everyone wants because of the name, but it's the way that it's doled out is kind of confusing. It's some years
it's crappy.
Some years their decisions are okay, and some years they're okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's bull. I hate that so much. And you know, the other thing that's equivalent to that is, you know, all the really cool creators who get awesome bits in the New York Times that are like the first mention of them in that publication. Like Howard Zinn, right? Howard Zinn died. He there was not only a great obit, there was also a column by Bob Herbert where he talked about like, you know, I used to hang out with Howard all the time. He was awesome. It's like, what? You never gave a brother any love, right? You never like once said, you know, in your column, oh, the other day Howard Zinn told me. Yeah, it's totally disgusting.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And my guests today are comics journalists Ted Rawl and Matt Bors. Matt is this year's winner of the Herblock Prize for Political Cartooning. Ted is the author most recently of The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. There's a great moment, Matt, in the Herblock Prize acceptance speech where you say that the award came with a $15,000 check, and that was more money than you made from all of your cartooning last year.
Yeah. The dark secret, or I don't know if it is a secret, is that cartooning really doesn't bring you much money. And especially in political cartooning, there's kind of a gigantic divide between people who have jobs and who don't. I mean, if you have a job, you can be making six figures if you're at a big paper. If you're not, it can be hard to crack 10 grand in a year because rates are basically so low that you have to have hundreds of clients to make a good living. So
and it's impossible to have hundreds of clients anymore.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I love what I do, and I got that Herblock money to kind of shore up my finances. But yeah, in the long run, it's still kind of the cartooning thing is not the career to get in if you want to make money.
Yeah,
or survive.
And your
or have health insurance.
Your strip Idiot Box, Matt, runs in the weekly Portland Mercury here in town, and Ted's strip used to run locally in the Willamette Week, but sad to say that paper seems to have dumped all of its cartoons.
Yeah, well, I don't, really? Yeah, they don't run anything right now. I don't understand when papers do not run comics at all. I mean, they're always shown to be some of the most popular content, and
especially with alt weeklies. Yeah. I mean, from the very beginning, comics were at the absolute center of, you know, back to the Village Voice in the mid 50s. You could always see, you know, a successful weekly would have lots of comics. I remember living in New York in the mid 90s, the paper that had the most comics was the New York Press. They had about 12 to 14 strips at any given point, and you could sit on the subway and just watch people. You know, they'd pick it up outside the subway, they'd sit down and they'd literally just look at the index and flip to the comics, and which were like spread through the classifieds in order to get people to look at the classifieds. And then people would look at the comics first and then go back to the beginning and start reading.
And as everything is transferred online, we just haven't seen they haven't brought over cartoons for some strange reason, even though, I mean, cartoons online are incredibly popular, more popular than a lot of articles, but news sites just don't really run them. I mean, Daily Coast started running some political cartoons, like me and Tom Tomorrow and some other people, and you can just look at like the share numbers for the little social networking buttons and see that it's some of the most popular content on the site. I mean, it just blows away a lot of this stuff because these things are made for this kind of world where we're sharing things and emailing them and posting them on our Facebook walls. And for whatever reason, most sites just haven't got hip to actually paying decent money like they do, the way they do writers.
Yeah. I mean, we're not even talking like one-tenth decent. I mean, it's kind of crazy. Like, you know, Slate uses, I think, both of us from time to time. And, you know, it's good to be on Slate. You know, people report seeing it. But the rates are insane. I mean, it literally, if you work it out, it'll be like, wow, I got $1.88 or I got 52 cents. I mean, this is insane. I mean, I started doing comics for my little local paper in Kettering, Ohio, when I was 16 years old. And they paid me $25 a cartoon. Yeah. I mean,
well, and what's a shame is, I mean, here's a list of people who aren't doing political cartoons that were 5 years ago. You know, Michaela Reed, August Pollock, Lloyd Dangle, David Reese, Tim Kreider. Right there. I mean, those are
five. These are top talents, too.
Yeah. But people are just giving up, kind of, because it's just it's brutal. A lot of cartoonists that you know, they're shoring up their finances by the fact that they probably have a spouse who has a decent job that provides health insurance. I mean,
it's essential.
If you want to have,
yeah, really, truly,
if you want to have a do anything like you're supposed to do for a normal nuclear family in America, buy a house and send kids to school or have health insurance, you just got to find a good spouse because cartooning is.
Although, the problem now is going to be, I mean, seriously, things are still getting so much worse all the time that I wonder if, like, the problem is not even going to be, like, lack of money. It's going to be just that no one, it's like if you throwing a cartoon into a bottle and throwing it into the river. I mean, nobody is going to run them in any place that matters. I mean, you can put them on your blog, you can put them, you know, you can put them out there, but who cares? It's like there's no relevance anymore. It's just what's crazy about it is usually when lines of business fail, it's because they weren't successful with the customers. But here it's the gatekeepers that are preventing the customers from buying a popular product. It's as if everyone really enjoyed McDonald's hamburgers and really wanted to eat them. And they're like, man, I sure could go for a quarter pounder right now. But McDonald's decided, nah, we're only going to like have radishes. And like people need to eat radishes. And so they just prevented. And like there was like a conspiracy on the part of all food providers to make hamburgers not available. That's what it's like.
I kind of feel though that I feel encouraged a lot of times just because they objectively political cartoons are popular, and I feel like the dam has to break online with the content.
It's been a long time.
You know, I mean, the thing that is both encouraging and frustrating for me is that over the last 2 years especially, and recently with these like awards and things like that, I mean, I've been getting a lot of attention and my cartoons are more popular than ever online. I mean, my readership has grown significantly in the last year, but not that many papers have really picked me up. So those are what bring in the actual income. And, you know, I don't have my website monetized that much. It's hard to do, but
it's really
the readership
hard.
Is there.
Well, there are plenty of amazing webcomics out there that's original work, original ideas, great stuff that's happening on the internet. And one of the great sites is one, Matt, that you have been heavily involved with since the beginning. You're sort of a stalwart of the Cartoon Movement website. And for example, up there right now, David Axe, who you've worked with before, author, has a comic about the Army of God. There's the one that you sort of arranged, Life in Haiti, Tents Beyond Tents, with Jean Jerome and Chevalin Pierre. And there's a project that Cartoon Movement's doing with the London School of Economics and Political Science. There's Cartoonists Under Pressure. So you're bringing in cartoonists from around the world who are being repressed, and you're giving them great global exposure.
Yeah, so I'm the comics journalism editor there, which is kind of came out of the trip I did to Afghanistan with Ted, actually. And so Yeah, what I'm doing is finding people from all around the world who are doing comics journalism, and we're publishing it, and we have some, in my opinion, some pretty amazing stuff. And we did a project to go to Haiti, and I got some Haitian journalists and paired them up with the cartoonist you mentioned, Chevelin, that are doing some great stuff. We only have the first chapter up now, but the next one should be up in about a month. It's kind of going to be Scott McCloud did Understanding Comics, and it's going to be sort of an understanding NGOs in Haiti type thing.
Oh, non-government organizations?
Yeah, where the writer, Robinson Giffard, is going to appear in the comic and speak as the narrator. It's going to have some kind of infographics type stuff, as opposed to the first one we did, which was more kind of a story about people living in tent camps.
That was a beautiful full-color story. I mean, which contrasts with the fact that Haiti has, not recovered well at all from the earthquake.
I was there almost a year ago now for a month in July and August last year, and there were still 600,000 people living in tent camps. I mean, every public space, and there aren't a lot of public spaces in Haiti, but every public space that existed was just filled with people living in little makeshift tents, because almost everything in the city had crumbled because of the horrible construction.
And there's a new piece. Josh Neufeld, the author of AD After the Deluge, the graphic memoir about Hurricane Katrina. Josh has published a story on Cartoon Movement called Bahrain, Lines in Ink, Lines in the Sand. And Josh has been nominated, I guess, for an Eisner Award, named after the great cartoonist and humanitarian Will Eisner, for Best Digital Comic.
Yeah. So, hoping that he gets that. It was a pretty excellent piece. It was about these two Bahraini political cartoonists, actually.
Mohammed and Sara. It's a true life story that follows these two editorial cartoonists.
Yeah, and they kind of ended up on opposite sides of the Arab Spring. In Bahrain, it was called the Pearl Revolution, and which wasn't successful as of yet.
Uh-huh. So what's the plight of Mohammed and Sara right now?
I don't know what the update is after the comic, but I don't want to get ahead of any thing that Neufeld may have not announced, but I believe he's going to do more on that and expand it.
Oh, great.
And that's actually what I love about my role in Cartoon Movement, is giving artists money so they can work on stuff like this, is that a lot of projects are coming out of it. So I think Neufeld is expanding his piece on these Bahraini cartoonists. I published some comics from Occupy DC by Stephanie McMillan, who is expanding that into a book that's coming out in the fall by Seven Stories. And we're publishing a graphic novel by David Axe that's about the Lord's Resistance Army in Congo.
Mm-hmm. And there's a traveling exhibition, There Is More Than One Truth, that's been a global traveling exhibition of political cartoons throughout the Middle East and other places.
Yeah, in addition to the comics journalism, what we really publish most of is political cartoons from around the world. So my partner in crime there, Geert Royards, who's a Dutch editorial cartoonist, he is kind of the founder and the main editor of the site, deals with the political cartoonists, and I do the comics journalism.
Well, here's a fun fact. Matt, before the Afghanistan trip with Ted, you didn't even have a passport. And and that was in, August of 2010. And since then, you seem to have made a point of traveling to sweltering places with no air conditioning in the month of August. It's Haiti last year. And you're thinking, is this right, about Libya this summer?
Well, I was, but it didn't pan out. So, I don't think I can put together a trip this quickly. But so I think this year I'm going to have to take a break, maybe. But no, I really, I do have a desire to keep doing this stuff. I think we both do. Ted's trying to do his, Kickstarter to go around the world to dangerous places in particular.
You've got the traveling bug.
Yeah. And I love traveling, but I think more than that, I have the comics journalism bug. I kind of feel like comics journalism is one of the last really unexplored genres in cartooning. I mean, we have thoroughly explored superheroes, sci-fi, fantasy. Memoir has been gone through very well, autobio.
Well, not well, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
exhaustively, let's say that.
Yeah, exhaustively.
But, nonfiction work that is not about the cartoonist themselves, that is about places and
looking
people.
Looking outward instead of inward.
Obviously the person that is always referred back to is Joe Sacco, one of the main people that has done this type of stuff. But I think in the last few years, I mean, it's really made a leap in the amount of people that are doing this stuff. And I feel in like 5 years, there's going to be a serious, good foot or two of a bookshelf with some serious comics journalism work on it.
No, that's good to hear. And I guess Joe Sacco kind of got comics journalism going back in the day,
in the
late 90s.
Anyway.
Yeah. So where would you, who else would you put in that category outside the U.S.?
Well, there's the people I can think of are more recent, but like there's Guy Delisle, who's a Quebecois cartoonist, and he did books called Pyongyang and Shenzhen, and he did kind of a cool book about Jerusalem recently. There's a number of foreign cartoonists who do this. I think that Joe definitely is the first major American. Although, you can kind of argue that there's precedents. I mean, there's earlier examples of cartoon journalism. I mean, Bill Malden, really.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can go beyond that. I mean, even Thomas Nast did some cartoon journalism from the Franco-Prussian War.
Oh, wow.
Of 1870 to 1871.
Oh, man.
So it's not without precedent, but it's, it comes and goes. It's hard to get people to, it doesn't seem to like last very long. And, I don't think like most cartoonists can really do it, to be honest. It requires, most cartoonists prefer to be at home and behind their drafting table, and they have pretty individual lives, and the only time they socialize maybe with other cartoonists over beers, but they don't like to look out and go all over the world and expose themselves to uncomfortable, dangerous places and talk to people and learn foreign languages.
Yeah, and
it's
even
tough for them.
Comics itself is tough to do well. I mean, it requires being able to be, you have to be a good artist, a good storyteller, and a good writer to do anything, even if you want to draw, cartoon characters and sci-fi
storyteller
stuff.
Is the most important.
Yeah, you add,
it's so hard.
Needing journalistic chops on top of that, and that's, now you're dealing with like three major components you have to work with.
It's almost like music. Comics can be in a universal language.
Well, we found when we were in Afghanistan that it gave us kind of access to people who would maybe not want to talk or just found us interesting in the sense that we weren't mainstream reporters lugging around a bunch of equipment in SUVs with like bulletproof vests on, which is how a lot of most of the journalists or all of them travel over there. In Haiti even, when I went, it was a year and a half after the quake. I mean, people have been sitting in these sweltering tent camps for a year and a half, miserable, really
with
sick,
no infrastructure,
tired of white journalists coming to, take photographs of them and then and go back home, and it not benefiting them at all. So we definitely saw there were people who, were resentful of our presence. But when I showed people what we were doing, I mean, honestly, most people think it's cool, and people still want to be drawn, and they still think it's
magical.
Yeah.
It's kind of charming. It's charming,
I
mean, who doesn't like to be drawn?
And what I think you can do with comics that is hard to do in other mediums is, as I was traveling with a video journalist, we did some video journalism while we were down there, Caroline Binns, and she's great. But videotaping people, it requires setting up microphones, lights. You put people on the spot and they're on. They're talking like they want to be quoted for television, or they're answering how they think they are supposed to answer, or something like that. If you just sit down with somebody, what I would do is record some interviews with my iPhone. And I would just sit down with, I would just tell them what I was doing and sit there and talk to them for a while and sketch them. Not necessarily a sketch that would go into a comic, but just kind of to kind of relax the mood and get into it and just interview them that way. And I think you can get a lot more out of someone doing that than you can, putting them on the spot with a camera, or at least,
especially in countries where photography is haram, right?
Yeah.
Like in Afghanistan.
But also maybe you don't get better stuff all the time. You just kind of get a different side of people than you do if you, put a camera in their face.
There's also an anonymity issue, right? Like, wasn't it Susie Cagle who was writing about that on her blog? She's done a lot of stuff from inside the Occupy Oakland movement. And she was talking about how in cartoon journalism, you can provide, you can draw someone, but change a little detail or, you know, not maybe mention their name.
Yeah.
And you're documenting what happened, the essence of what happened, but not imperiling your source.
Yeah. And that was even some comics that I didn't get around to actually drawing because the editing of the Haiti project consumed so much of my time. But I did some interviews when I was down there with some gay Haitians that have it even rougher than everyone else living in the tent camps because there's just zero infrastructure to support them. I mean, there's hardly any GLBT groups, no awareness of it. It's a deeply homophobic country. So anyway, these people are mostly living in the closet, even from their own family members that they live in a tent with. I mean...
They're in a closet inside a tent. Come on, I had to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's listening. They want someone to say that.
but you know, I was showing them, they were really concerned about being identified. And so what I did was I drew a picture with this guy I interviewed and showed him that I was going to draw the actual speech bubble with his words over his face. Once I showed him that, he was like, yeah, cool.
It's so awesome that way. It's such a great art form. I mean, you know, when I saw Sacco's stuff, all I could see was like, oh my God, this has so much potential.
Yeah. When we talk about it, it's remarkable to me that it's taken so long for it to kind of catch on as a thing. I mean, here we are, comics are a storytelling medium. I mean,
I'm surprised magazines don't all do this. Like, I don't know why this isn't in like, you know, like the New Yorker doesn't have like 10 pages of this every issue.
For one thing, it's really hard to do because you have to... Joe Sacco's going to the Jerusalem ministry that has all of this photo reference that is necessary for him to get the stuff right, for example.
It takes way more time than just, you know, drawing a comic about characters you made
but
up in your
lots
head
of good
fighting.
Cartoonists.
But yeah, you know, and maybe it takes longer than writing prose, but I think the effect is worth it. And, you know, now that I'm editing Cartoon Movement, I'm doing panels on comics journalism and traveling, and I always have to answer the question, like, why comics? Why does journalism work in comics? And it's like, I almost find the basis of it.
It's like, well, have you ever looked at them?
Yeah, I mean, no one would question fundamentally why prose for journalism? Why documentary? I mean, it's
why
just, clearly, it's a storytelling medium.
Well, it wouldn't be a question in places like Belgium or France where you have Mobius and folks who are doing wide-ranging stories.
And also where the newspapers and magazines use this a lot of cartoons and cartoon journalism.
Yeah, well, that's
a lot of cross-platform promotion.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of when I start to feel encouraged a little bit. You know, you say, well, there should be 10 pages of comics journalism in the New Yorker. Why isn't there? I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel like maybe there will be in 15 years. I mean, 15 years is too long. But, you know, I feel like, all right, infographics, which is kind of related to comics journalism, is just huge right now. I mean, every nonprofit, every news outlet is slapping together infographics because... You know what? If you do them right, and there are some amazing infographics that have been put out in the last year especially, if you do them right, it's better than, you know, reading a wire copy article about whatever, the jobless rate. Or it just, you can absorb the information better. You can, so whether it's political cartoons or infographics or comics journalism, it's like, you know, people out there love it. It's just kind of, you have to break through to these words editors who are kind of biased in favor of words.
Right. I mean, the thing is, what's really funny about these editors, I mean, you know, nobody, you could really never bash them enough. But, but what's amazing about them is, you know, here they are objectively presiding over a business that is doing poorly, to be charitable. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, in the case of newspapers, their circulation has been steadily declining since the early 1960s. Most people aren't aware of that. You know, they don't want anything edgy that might stimulate some discussion. I mean, what you want is for people to call each other and say, hey, did you see that thing in the Oregonian?
Yeah, because in the short term, what they're trying to do is they don't want something that's going to offend any readers or cause them to cancel the subscription. And then, like you said, these chains buying them up, it's wire copy, it's bland centrist columnists and, you know, inoffensive editorial cartoons for sure, you know, which thrived in the 80s and 90s.
And inoffensive comics.
And I mean, God, the standard for a daily paper is higher than almost anything, higher than television, which is notoriously hard to get stuff by. I mean, I couldn't use the word douchebag
In a column.
You can't say sucks in a cartoon. I mean, think of what kind of language is on Family Guy now. And you can't, you know, you can't, it's like... They haven't, in all aspects, dailies have just kind of dropped the
ball. They're stuck in the 1950s. But the point is that, okay, so they have a terrible business model, right? And, like, you would think that these people would be like, you know, we're dying here. We have to take some chances. We need to do something new. We need to rethink this whole thing. But no, they're not. They're not only, it's not even like they're hunkered down and afraid and just climbing the mast as the ship goes down. They think they're doing awesome. They think they're great. They go home at 4:59 every day. They really think they're the cat's meow. They think they've got all the answers. They think they have nothing to learn from anyone. It's the combination of failure and arrogance is incredible. It's like they're politicians.
As a Gen Xer, I noticed recently that you are a contributing editor to the late lamented Might magazine founded by Dave Eggers back
That's
in the
true.
90s.
Yes, I was.
That was a short-lived but really, really wonderful. One of those magazines that took people as serious readers and thinkers, which meant it wouldn't last very long.
Yeah, well, it was a great run. I mean, you know, it's funny, like the first issue and the last issue suck. You know, the first issue starts out real like naive and like, you know, 20 somethings that are doing 20 great things, and it's for real. You know,
the
it's not ironic.
Listicle.
And then after that, suddenly, immediately to issue two, which is when I came on board, it was like we're going totally ironic and taking the piss out of this kind of stuff. And it got real smart, and then like went all the way on, and then like at the end, it got serious and it died. But it was always a struggle. You know, I mean, it was like hard to get distribution. It was hard to get people to pay attention. But it was a farm system. You know, a lot of writers came out of that. You know, Smith Magazine was Larry Smith. He came out of Might. There was people who are now like at Forbes, and you know, Dave Eggers himself went to Esquire, and then of course, obviously, fame and fortune as an author and publisher. So a lot of people did pretty well who came out of it. I mean, I think that the thing that people are maybe not aware of is that Dave is like probably one of the best editors around. And, you know, people think of him as a great writer, but he's an amazing editor. Just like, you know, he helps you find your voice. He's uncompromising. He's brilliant. And he did that for a lot of people.
What's coming up for both of you, Ted and Matt? What's next now that you've won every award there is or been shortlisted or whatever? Or, you know, you've traveled all over the globe. So what's next?
Well, you certainly can't plan awards, you know. I mean, I was pretty sure that I might win some awards the year that I came back from Afghanistan, and I didn't. So obviously, there was no interest in unembedded editorial
cartooning.
You gave
Matt a leg up, though.
That's true.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Beers are on you.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
I'm working on a book about my Afghan trip for R. Strauss and Giroux. It's been kind of like delayed because my editor there like quit and went to another publisher. So now I have a new editor and we're editing it. So it should come out in the spring of 2013. And, you know, I'm kind of trying to figure out what to do next. I've been like thinking about doing this graphic novel. It has a working title of American Messiah. It's a what if a kid was born in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and thought that he was the son of God. But instead of it being a parody of religion, which I think is, I tend to not like them. I tend to think they're facile, and I don't really, and I think religion is so absurd that it doesn't even need to be parodied. But it's really a send-up of media. Like, you know, in this day and age, it would be impossible with the fragmentation of media for a messiah, real or imagined, to spread his message. It would be impossible.
I wonder how many Twitter followers he could get.
Right, exactly. So there's lots of potential for that. And of course, obviously, he has to be executed as a terrorist, as Jesus was. So it just completely follows that like narrative.
So people would be wearing little drones around their necks. Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures on KABU. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and our guests today have been comics journalists Ted Rall and Matt Bors. Matt is this year's winner of the Herblock Prize for Political Cartooning. Ted is the author most recently of The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Matt and Ted, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. This show will be available later today on the Words and Pictures archive page. That's KBOO.FM/Words and Pictures. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your community radio station. Feel the sun.
see your shadow.